So I just mentioned that my intro class, my introduction to mindfulness class, and this Wednesday will be the last evening, the sixth evening. And it's somewhat unusual that I teach 6 weeks. Usually this intro class is 5 weeks long. And this time around, I was inspired to add 1 week into it. And I would like to talk about what I added. Some of you maybe have taken the intro class before, and you would have missed this part of the introduction because I didn't teach it before. And as I think many of you know, the basic idea of mindfulness is to pay attention, to learn to pay attention to what is happening in the present moment. And for many people, it's a challenge to really maintain our attention in the present moment, in the lived experience, in the experience of our life as we're living it. There's such a strong tendency of the mind to rehearse the past, relive the past, or fantasize about the future, or be in fantasy about the present. And to really have a quality presence, a stable here, to really notice what's happening here, is somewhat unusual. Even people who are in the present moment fairly well, many of you probably were pretty well in the present moment driving here, if you drove here. You couldn't be too far away from what was happening. But the quality of that attention perhaps was not as strong as it's possible to be. And one of the things we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to strengthen that capacity for the attention to be stabilized in the present moment so we can see much more clearly what is here. And so when we teach mindfulness, we often teach about some of the areas of your life that you can pay attention to. It's kind of like giving the map of a terrain, a territory. And once you have the map, it's easier to find your way in it. So we could just say, you know, give the instructions very briefly and say, pay attention. But that's pretty vague, and what are you supposed to pay attention to? So we kind of draw out this, you know, the map. And the map, as given here at IMC, the intro class generally begins with mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing being a very good place to stabilize the attention, to train the attention to be in the present moment. Your breathing is always in the present moment. And then the next instruction has to do with the body, mindfulness of the body. And the body also is always in the present. Your body is not going to be anywhere else. So if you're connected to your body, you're connected to the present moment. And much of our life is mediated or expressed or manifested through our body. So being embodied is a very helpful practice for cultivating attention. It's also a little bit an antidote to the idea that attention or mindfulness is all about the mind, something, you know, some disembodied kind of attention. A lot of the attention, the awareness we're cultivating could be said to kind of mediated through the body, with the body. The Zen master Dogen talked about mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, and he said, mindfulness of the body is the body's mindfulness. I kind of like that. So it's not so much like you're mindful of the body, but the body itself has a sensitivity, this awareness. And then the third week, I usually talk about mindfulness of feelings, of emotions, and a huge part of human life. Then the fourth week is mindfulness of thinking. So the way I often teach it, then these four areas, you know, are part of the terrain, the territory being pointed to. And now what I added this time around was another area, which is not just another thing that your mind can focus on, but in a sense is to turn the attention around and notice the mind itself. Not just the content of the mind, the thoughts or the feelings or things like that, but to turn around and actually look at the quality of the mind, the mood of the mind, the state of the mind that the mind is in. And sometimes it's not so easy to notice the overall state or the mood or the quality of the mind because we're focusing so much on the details of what's happening. If there's something we really want, we might be focusing on that thing that we want. If something we're trying to avoid, we're somehow focusing on avoiding that thing. And but the quality of the mind is we don't pay attention to. Maybe somewhat like if you take your hand, if you want to grasp something because you really want that thing, or if you want to push that thing away, you're focusing on what you're trying to accomplish, not on the degree of tension in your hand. And so you might be surprised at the end of the day how tired your hand is, because there might have been a lot of extra effort in the hand in grasping or pushing away. And but if you paid attention to what's happening in the hand, the quality of the muscles in the hands, you might notice, oh, there's a lot of extra tension in the way I grasp or the way I push. Maybe I didn't need to do it that way, or I didn't even know I was grasping. Look at that. And so it's turning away from the objects of what we want or don't want and looking at the quality. Now to get this get to this a little bit different way, there are I like to say that there are two things always happening in any given moment. There is what is happening, which is, you know, in a sense what I said earlier, the definition of mindfulness, paying attention with what's happening in the present moment. There's what's happening. And then there's also your relationship to what's happening. So there's what's happening in your relationships to what's happening. So and that's, you know, in all, almost everything that's going on, we have a relationship to what's going on. We're for it, we're against it. We have some opinions, judgments, ideas about what's happening. We bring ourselves as a certain kind of individual, sense of self, self-identity. We measure what's happening according to how it benefits us or how it takes away from us. We come with some motivation, some attitude, some, you know, something we want. It can be quite beautiful. It could be what we want is we want compassion. We want to help someone. Still, that's the attitude. That's the relationship we have. Someone's suffering, we want to help. We see a beautiful bell. It's a beautiful bell we have here at IMC. And then someone thinks, I want that bell. So there's a sound, and then there's the relationship to it is I want something. So in almost every possible thing we could pay attention to notice, there's also embedded in that, or holding that, or entangled with it, is the way we relate to that, our attitude to it, the way we approach it, what we want, how we motivate it in relationship to it. And so to turn the attention around or take a backward step and look at the what's the relationship I have with this experience, or what's the attitude I have to what this experience is. And that attitude can be with the specific aspect of what's happening here and now. So I'm driving on the freeway and the traffic is slowed down. That's what's happening. And then there's the attitude about slow traffic on the freeway. And that attitude might be specific to that particular day. I'm late to get somewhere. So there could be the attitude is one of irritation. The world is holding me up. Doesn't the world realize I'm an important person? I have important places to go. Or it might be that the attitude comes with a huge history of being stuck in traffic on 101. And so the frustration of having this repeated problem with the traffic, that attitude of frustration is there as well. That's not just specifically today, but has to do with the much bigger picture of what's happening. And if we don't notice the attitude that we have to what's happening, then that attitude can be there and fester. It can build up stress and tension. And one of the things I think many of you can realize is that something that's very relatively mild tension or stress, if it's chronically held or chronically reinforced throughout a day, can build and build and build. And it's not so, you know, even though it's innocent enough in the moment, having it build up all through the day, you know, at the end of the day, there can be a lot of tension or headache or something. So there's a specific, you know, attitude. And the same thing in meditation practice. And in meditation practice in particular, at least I've found from many people and for myself at times, that I can be so kind of trying to do the instructions, focusing on the breath. I'm supposed to be with the breath. Just be with the breath. Or, oh, there's a pain. I'm supposed to be with the pain. Pay attention to the pain. Oh, there's an emotion. That's what I was told to do. Okay, now pay attention to the emotion. Feel that emotion. There's thinking. Okay, look at thinking. And I'm kind of engaged, in a sense, focusing this way, this way. And it might not occur to turn around and look at, how am I focusing? What's the attitude that's there with the focus? Because the way I'm focusing is not the practice. The practice is to look at the breath, right? But actually, how we're looking, how we're paying attention, how we're present, the attitude in which that it comes with it, is a very important part of the mindfulness practice. And I've known a lot of people whom, especially on longer retreats, it becomes obvious that they have some kind of attitude about how to be mindful, how to pay attention, which is a little bit off. And in practicing, you know, half an hour every morning, meditating at home, that little attitude is, you know, doesn't, the stresses of that attitude, the faults, the weaknesses or whatever, that attitude, doesn't stand out enough. But try meditating all day for several days in a row or a week in a row, and so these things start to, the weak links begin to crack or break. And so I've had the experience in my early retreats where I thought, you know, my attitude about meditation was me, the great doer, the great agent, the great successful meditator. I'm in charge here, and I'm going to get concentrated, and I'm just going to focus on that breath and really zero in. And so when I did that at home, you know, for 40 minutes, basically I was kind of stressed out, and just the fact that I stopped and wasn't running around, you know, with all my life, just that was relaxing. And it just kind of unwinding a little bit. And I kind of took credit for it. Because, oh, you know, I'm the one who's meditating. I'm the good concentrator. Wow, look what I did. I didn't do anything. I just kind of stopped and just my muscles relaxed. But so I took credit for it. But then I go on retreat. And that initial kind of relaxation would settle away. And that attitude of me, I'm supposed to concentrate. I'm the one who can concentrate. Was still operating, and it wouldn't work. That attitude just didn't kind of work for, you know, getting settled, getting peaceful, really being present in a kind of quality way. And so on retreat, this stood out and got highlighted in a very painful way. And it didn't occur to me to turn the attention around and look at my attitude and my beliefs and everything that I was doing. And so in my unfortunate circumstances, I had to burn and crash. Meditation. You know, you don't associate meditation with burning and crashing. But I burned and crashed. And, just because I was kind of trying so hard, pushing and pushing and trying to focus. And the more I tried, the worse less would work. And so finally, I just gave up. And when I gave up, that's when the meditation started. That's when it began unfolding for me. So that's a rather unfortunate story. Is kind of to illustrate this idea that it's possible to ignore the attitude because you're trying to accomplish something and doing something. And I think that meditation practice unfolds much more peacefully, much more smoothly, if periodically, not every minute, but periodically you actually turn around, see what's my attitude, what's my approach, what's my relationship to meditation, what's my relationship to the breath, what's the relationship to myself as I'm doing this, and include that in the field of what's happening. And the relationship we have could also be perhaps is closely connected to the sense of the attitude we have. And it's also connected to the state of the mind, the overall state of the mind. And I would say that Buddhist spirituality, kind of the heart of Buddhism, is not so much about what is happening in terms of the breath or the feelings or the thoughts or about sounds or whatever, you know, we could say what's happening. The heart of Buddhism really lays in this issue of the relationship we have with whatever's happening. And that means that at least in a sense, we're not trying to change what's happening. We're trying to discover a new relationship, a relationship which is healthy, wholesome, and ultimately a relationship which is liberated or freed. So we're trying to find, you know, so always kind of going back and looking. That's where the heart of it is in the relationship. This is so central. The relationship we have, the attitude we have to what's going on, is so central to who we are that my interpretation of the teachings of the Buddha is that this is called the mind. The mind is characterized by this attitude or relationship we have to our experience. The word for mind is, or mind state, is citta. And citta in Buddhist language also means heart, or can be kind of mind, heart, heart, mind. And so I like this because if you say mind, for some people that doesn't seem very warm. But say heart, for some people that's really kind of core, central to who they want to be, who they are, or something. So there's citta, so central. And the third foundation of mindfulness that the Buddha taught was not thinking, or not emotions. You know, so some people think that I'm teaching the four foundations of mindfulness when I do the intro class. I teach you breath, body, feelings, and thoughts. And it's not actually the case, even though it happens before. The Buddha has a different foundations. And the third foundation of mindfulness for the Buddha is mindfulness of the citta, or the mind state. The overall kind of what the state or the attitude that characterizes the mind. And that attitude is sometimes specific, as I said earlier, to a particular event. But sometimes an attitude of the mind is actually much more like a disposition that we carry with us, regardless of what's happening in the moment. So we bring it with us, the attitude. So there might be an attitude of impatience that maybe a person has. And regardless of where you go, that sense of impatience is there with you. Or there might be an attitude of aversion. And so no matter where we're going, that aversion is there. And perhaps even though in a particular moment is characterized by desire or delight in a particular thing, the background mood, there's still there a background mood of aversion that's maybe masked for the moment, but give it half a chance and it'll resurface. There could be a background mood of compassion or kindness that maybe is not the operating thing in the moment because maybe it's superseded by something in the moment. But that thing in the moment, if that goes away, then that background attitude might be this, you come back to this default of compassion. So it's default. Where does the mind go as a default? What's the background attitude that we have? And this background attitude, you know, is for some people is really kind of the heart of some of the, at the heart of what makes them tick, what motivates their life, and at the heart for what many people suffer, what causes, where people feel, where people are trapped or caught in their suffering or in their life. So to turn around and look at the attitude is not just to look at the attitude of the moment, but also, if you do it well and do it, you stabilize your mind, you're stable and calm and be able to look clearly, it begins to surface and show the underlying attitude that might be very pervasive. So when I taught this class on Wednesday, there was someone who spoke up and said that he was surprised to realize that fear or anxiety was pervasive. Was always there for him. He had no idea. He knew there was an issue in his life around anxiety, but he had no idea that it was always there. And that's not uncommon for people to come and tell me this, that they were surprised to discover a background attitude or mood. Sometimes it's not so healthy or helpful. That's always there, always in the background. It's often can also be connected to kind of a belief about what the world is like. So a belief, for example, the world is a threatening place, or a belief that to be successful in life, you have to have a lot of things, or you have to look smart, or you have to look beautiful, and so, or people have to like you, or an attitude that, a belief that, the world is a threatening place, or a belief that the world is here to serve us, to benefit me. So there's always kind of this attitude is often connected to beliefs as well. The relationship we have is connected to our beliefs, beliefs about ourselves and these things. So in the teachings of the Buddha, it's the third foundation of mindfulness, which focuses on this quality of the mind, the state of the mind, the overall kind of mood or state. And so the way that that's talked about here in this ancient instruction, how does a person abide mindful mindful of the mind as mind? Here, a person understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. Lust could be expanded just to become called greed or craving or desire. But lust, you know, so there could be a strong desire that is not just desire of the moment, you know, a particular thing in the mind, but actually colors the mind. The whole mind is kind of suffused with this kind of attitude of desire. It's a background desire. It's filled with desire. You can see people sometimes and you can notice, wow, that person's kind of on fire with lust. I mean, look at that. You know, it's so obvious. And he doesn't realize it. But, you know, so it's not just simply there's a desire, and you know, particular desire, moment of desire that arises, but it just kind of colors the whole kind of state. So it's possible to know that for oneself. You can know when there's this craving or clinging or lust is present, and know when it's not. One understands a mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and the mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. So there's this kind of dichotomy, in a sense, being looked at here. The presence and absence. Either it's there or it's not there. You can't be partially pregnant, they say. So either you're, you know, either there's strong desire, either there's desire in the mind, or there's not desire. There's not, you know, partial desire. Because if there's partial desire, then there's desire. So what the instruction here is simply to notice the presence and absence of these things. And what's very instructive around this instruction is that it doesn't say, notice that the mind is characterized by lust, and then criticize yourself for that. Notice the mind is filled with hate, and then hate yourself for that. Or justify it, or whatever. It's very simple, just notice the presence and absence. And the advantage of noticing the absence is kind of a strange thing, because the absence, you know, it's not, you know, it's like nothing there, right? We're supposed to pay attention to what's there. But in absence, if something's been present for a while, strong mood or mental state and attitude, it's very helpful or instructive to get a sense of what the mind feels like when it's not there, as a contrast. And for one thing, knowing when it's not there, really recognizing it, oh, it's not there now, reinforces, in a sense, the value of it not being there. Perhaps you can feel sometimes that the mind is not driven by hate, when the hate is no longer there. It's a higher quality of mind. It's a more satisfying mind. It's a more peaceful mind. And so it's nice to see, oh, this is what the mind is like when it's not filled with hate. And then when the hate reappears, that contrast helps do the highlighting, helps help you understand more deeply what's going on. Also, the more you can appreciate the absence of something, it's more like you're getting a massage. The more you you're getting used to the experience of not being caught in the grip of a particular mood or attitude. So then it goes on and says, one understands a mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. Then one understands a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as a distracted mind. So it's possible to sit down to meditate, for example, and realize, wow, my mind is really distracted. And 5 minutes later, oh yeah, I'm really distracted today. That was 5 minutes where I wasn't even present. And so then you can get curious, what is a distracted mind feel like? What's a distracted mind like? As opposed to criticizing and pushing it away and saying, oh, I'm not supposed to be distracted, I'm supposed to focus on the breath. maybe the breath is not the point, but maybe the point, the important place now is to turn the attention around, to look at the quality of the mind or the heart and see, oh, the quality is one of destructibility, of being contracted, being scattered, being fragmented. And then to take that in, because the taking it in, the feeling it, being present for it, helps us not be caught in the midst of it, caught in the grip of it. Taking it in is actually, in some degree, kind of healing. And the way I like to describe that is that if we give our system space, air, room, then things have a chance to unfold or unravel, dissolve, evolve, in whatever way they're supposed to evolve, dissolve, unravel. But if we're claustrophobic in the mind, we're so preoccupied and concerned and upset and pushing and lost in thought or whatever, there's no room for things to unwind. And mindfulness has the function of creating room in the mind, space in the mind. So if you notice, oh, this is a distracted mind, and you step back, in a sense, make room for that and stay present, feel that's what it's like, then you're making room, and perhaps that distracted mind can settle itself, can relax. And then it goes on, one understands, an exalted mind as exalted mind, an unexalted mind as an unexalted mind. An exalted mind, in its translation, means a mind which is starting to get concentrated and is kind of changed, come into a little bit of an altered state that's not the normal state of being distracted or preoccupied we're in, but the mind somehow has become spacious, light, open, soft, malleable. So the quality of the mind has been to shift. And there's a higher quality of heart or mind is being, you know, is there. So to know, oh, this is a good quality. And I would say that one of the most, the most precious thing that any of us have is the quality of our mind, the good quality of our mind or our heart. And the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen in this universe of ours is not art, is not some beautiful thing in nature, is not looking deep into the galaxies in a beautiful way we can these days, but rather the most beautiful thing I've seen is a purified heart, a liberated heart, a settled, peaceful heart. And I think that's something that all of us hopefully have access to, something that's a possibility for all of us. I remember a little story. When I went to Nepal to practice there, I had very little money. And I think I had $300 to my name. And there I was in Nepal, you know, to practice. You know, I'd gone to Asia to practice for the duration. It was the end of the line for me. Nothing else had any meaning for me, and I was gone to practice. And the teacher I wanted to practice with was doing a month-long retreat in Nepal, and so I went there to practice with him, and with my $300 for him. And so I had a few days to wait before the retreat started. So I was walking around Kathmandu, and they have all these kind of tourist shops that sell a lot of Buddhist art. And the windows, you know, with Buddhist art, statues and stuff in it. And there was one window where they had a statue in Buddha that really spoke to me. This really kind of struck me. It was $100. And so I went around for a couple of days. Should I buy it? You know, it really speaks to me. It's meaningful for me. And, you know. So I was going around debating my mind. And a third of my wealth to buy a Buddha. That seems, you know, too much. So I was wondering, you know. And so then, lo and behold, out of the blue, as far as I was concerned, well, what happened was I made a phone call back to Berkeley, where my girlfriend lived. And her roommate said, oh, she left yesterday for Nepal to be with you. And I said, oh. She doesn't even know where Kathmandu is big. How do you find guilt? You know, how do you find how is she supposed to find me even? And so I went out to the airport and put a big note on the bulletin board, hoping that she'd see it. And anyway, we eventually were connected. So she showed up, but she had even less money than I did. And so here we were, the two of us in Kathmandu, and me thinking about buying this Buddha. And then my decision was I would not buy the Buddha, because the most beautiful thing I knew was a purified heart. And I would save my money to help her so she could practice in Asia. I think that's a nice story. So to somehow, the beauty of one's own heart. So to be the caretaker, the custodian of your own heart, of your own mind, to look at it, take it seriously. It's a really precious resource, a precious part of who we are. And it's very easy to take for granted. It's very easy to lose touch with it. It's very easy to get caught up in the day-to-day concerns. Or even in meditation, it's easy to get caught up in the ideas we have of what's supposed to happening and, you know, trying to accomplish something. And we don't actually take in or stay aware of what's the quality of this heart-mind that's always here. The heart-mind always has a quality. It always has almost always has an attitude. It always has some way it's in relationship to either the details or to the big picture. We have an attitude, a relationship to life itself, or what our life is about, or who we are. So to inquire, what is this attitude? What is this relationship that we have? What is this quality of mind, heart, that's here? And then it's important to remember that the instructions the Buddha gave here, there was no emphasis whatsoever on judging or criticizing, being upset with what you see. It's really a phenomenal thing. It's really an amazing thing to just see how it is. To be present and to see clearly. It's so phenomenal that I think of seeing clearly without judgment, without criticism, without even trying to change it. I understand that kind of seeing as a kind of love. So even if what we see within us is unfortunate, and maybe doesn't speak very well about who we are, what's going on, there's a way of kind of being present for that and seeing it. Being present and allowing it to be there, just seeing it very clearly, not being caught in it, that's actually an act of love in relationship to what we see. And slowly, I believe what will happen is that we keep coming back, trying to find that place of just being present and seeing. And we see the attitude that we have. We step back and we see the attitude. Very little bit at first, perhaps, we're stepping out of the gravitational pull, out of the orbit of that attitude. We're not in it. We're not caught by it. And the act of seeing helps us to kind of, helps us step out of it. And because we're not in it, the unhealthy attitudes and approaches begin to settle away, relax away. And amazingly enough, as we step back, the beautiful qualities of the mind-heart have a chance to shine and grow and become bigger and bigger. It's one of the miracles, I think, of the human heart, is that the act of attention, careful, steady, ongoing mindfulness, just that, has a way of somehow unraveling those forces in the heart which cause suffering and tend to augment or feed or nourish those forces in the heart that tend to bring out the best in us. So your attitude, your relationship, and the quality of your mind is part of the instructions. And that's part of the introductory instructions in mindfulness. So, we have a few minutes. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Now I wonder what attitude is out there. What relationship do you have with this? Yes, please.
So I get what you're saying about why it's important. What I don't get is how you examine it, except maybe through the first four things, that by becoming aware of those things, it might help you to understand or to get that attitude.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I think that the more we've cultivated mindfulness of breath, body, emotions, and thoughts, the more access we have to be able to notice what that attitude is. Because the attitude is often, that's where the attitude in some degrees is being manifested through those things. So the more embodied we are, the more we can notice the feeling tone, the what's going on. So these instructions are all kind of very closely connected. You can also kind of I think it's, some people it's possible to, if they're sensitive enough, to turn around, for example, and look at the quality of the mindfulness. Because being mindful, being present, noticing what's here, sometimes comes together with baggage. It comes together with other approaches or attitudes. So there might be a sense of trying to push. You can feel kind of pushing in the mind, or pressure in the mind, or resistance. Oh no, I don't want to pay attention to that. And it's feeling like pulling back. Okay, or the mind is contracted. Sometimes I feel like my mind is really tight and small. You know, it's kind of caught up in its little world of concerns. And sometimes my mind is, it's bigger than this room here. It's like, wow, I can handle anything. Bring it on. It's so big, the space for everything. And that sense of space is there. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Kind of on the same topic of the contracted versus expanded mind. It's easy to be expanded when you're in a group like this and people are positive and you're talking about, purified mind, and you can get in the mood and you can really feel it. And then you go visit some friends that are making $20,000 a year and they're really struggling and try to, say, but if you just had a purified mind, you would be happy. It's really hard to maintain that sense of, openness and beauty when people, it's really hard for them. And so you feel like pulling in and not sharing because you're going to make them feel bad or inadequate. And mm-hmm. How do you maintain that when other people just...
Well, I think that we want to look at our attitude. It could be that we have a wonderful expansive mind, and the attitude towards that expansive mind is, I want to keep this. I want this. This is important. I finally got it. And everyone should have this. there can be an attitude towards that. So I think for you, rather than trying to maintain it, I think what's more important is to bring mindfulness to what's happening for you in those kind of situations. What attitudes, what relationship do you have to their pain, their suffering, their demands? What attitude and relationship do you have to where you're at? What beliefs do you have connected to it? Try to understand what's going on with you. And probably there's a lot to unpack and understand about yourself and that relationship. And it might take a while to unpack everything that's going on. But until you unpack it, you might not be able to go into those situations without getting pulled into something or hooked. So how are you getting hooked? So I know for me, one of the ways I've gotten hooked plenty of times is my sense of responsibility. My Achilles heels is my sense of responsibility. I'm responsible somehow for this person's well-being, so somehow I have to get in there and adjust myself or fix or do something. And I've had to learn to kind of have an appropriate sense of responsibility, which partly for me has meant backing away from being responsible for other people's suffering. I can try to be helpful, but I'm not responsible.
But can you go into that situation, for example, there? They had a better understanding of finances and how to plan, that they could deal with. If they had a better understanding of finances and could plan their money better, that they would do better and they would feel better. But they aren't ready for that. So you say, well, okay, I can't help them. Can you say I can't help them and still feel compassionate and mindful of their suffering if you make the decision that you can't help them?
If you can't help, if you really can't help them, you'll feel a lot better accepting that's the fact than trying to help them knowing they can't. You can't, right? So, there can still, you can still have a lot of compassion and care for them, but realizing, regardless of my care and compassion, my willingness to help, I can't help right now. So what? I can't help them figure out their finances, but what can I do? Maybe it's enough just to be there, empathic with them. Maybe it's enough just to say, tell them, this is really hard, I'm sorry for you. Maybe it's enough just to sit there on the couch with them and cry. Oh, this is really hard. And no one's ever cried with them. And say, oh, this is more serious than I thought, they think. Oh, maybe I better do something, someone's crying. So the Buddhist practice that's most connected to some of what you're talking about here is equanimity. And the practice of equanimity is the practice of somehow staying balanced or non-reactive in a situation where we can't make a difference. We have to realize that others are responsible for their choices. And even though I'm trying to help or even have other wishes for them, I'm not going to be caught reactively by the choices they make.
Then the last piece would be, how do you truly convince yourself? Because not saying I can't is, in a sense, always easier, right? Because
right.
You can now stop. How do you convince yourself that you're really honestly being expansive and have done the most that you can, rather than, well, I tried for a couple of hours and that's about the most I feel like today, so I'm going to decide I can't and then I can quit and feel good about myself.
Yeah, it's hard. I think that I wish there were easy solutions to life. And I think that sometimes it takes a lot of attention to ourselves. I think the more mindful you are, the more you can pick up the cues in your own heart and mind to know what's going on with you. And so at least you're not bringing any kind of, you're not messing up the scene or yourself. You're coming as clean as you can be to the situation. That's helpful. So you try to do your work. And that sometimes takes years to really do one's own work, to be clean enough to go into very difficult situations. And so then it's a matter of trying to figure out, trying to do the very best we can. And sometimes doing the best we can, we do together with help with others. So you're asking here, but there might be, sometimes maybe going for a walk with a friend or talking to a therapist or someone about these kinds of dynamics and trying to understand, get to the bottom of some of the important issues for you before you enter into a difficult situation. There's a lot of things that can be done. It depends how much time and homework you want to do. But it sounds like an important one. It sounds really tricky and difficult. And it sounds like it could be really rich for you. And potentially a great opportunity for you to delve into some of the core beliefs that you have that affect the quality of your own heart. So we should stop now. But if some of you would like to come and talk up afterwards, that'd be fine. I'll stay a little bit. So I hope that each of you can appreciate how beautiful your heart is when it's really left alone. Thank you.